Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Prasky. You know about Walt Disney, the great filmmaker from Kansas City, but have you heard of another Kansas Cityan, world-class classical composer, Virgil Thompson? I bet you haven't, and I can tell you I hadn't. That may be about to change with a new PBS documentary tentatively titled Virgil Thompson, Identifying an American Voice. Excerpts from that work in progress will be screened tonight at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. More on that in just a few minutes. Later on this hour, reaction to President Obama's State of the Union address last night. We'll hear from Congressman Emanuel Cleaver and a Washburn University political scientist, and we'll want your reactions, too. But first up, Virgil Thompson, the great Kansas City composer who lived from 1896 to 1989. With us this morning, our filmmaker Amy Larrabee. Amy, nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. And also here is Andrew Grenade. He is chair of the Composition, Music Theory, and Musicology Division at the UMKC Conservatory of Music and Dance. And Andrew, nice to have you too.
Thanks,
Steve.
Good morning.
Well, Andrew, how is it possible that so many of us know nothing about Virgil Thompson?
I think partly it's that Thompson just isn't performed often. He wrote a swath of amazing works, but he just doesn't get the play in the theaters and in the conservatories that a lot of other composers do.
Well, Amy, if you meet somebody for the first time, do they know much about Virgil Thompson?
They really don't.
Yeah, I was going to say. Now I feel better because I didn't either.
I have to say I didn't as well, and I'm a native Kansas Cityan. So when Jim Arntz, my co-producer, who has a vast history with PBS, when he approached me about this, I was a little embarrassed because as a native Kansas Cityan, I didn't know much about Virgil, but he quickly got me enthused.
Well, thank you for making me feel better. He got you enthused. Why? What is it about Virgil Thompson in three or four sentences that we should know about this guy? Because he's a man of just incredible achievement here.
He really influenced American film music in all genres. He is, correct me, the only person to win
the Pulitzer Prize for film
composition.
Wow.
Born right here in Kansas City, just the depth and breadth of his work, from ballets to film composition to critical writing on music. Mm. He also really, truly captures the sense of the American heartland in music. Mm. It's beautiful.
Andrew Grenade, you'd add what to what Amy just said.
I really think that of among American composers, he's the one who first identified what America sounds like in music. He wrote a piece, a symphony on a hymn tune that was written in 1928. That piece was heard by Aaron Copland, who we usually think of.
I was just going to say, you're taking two words out of my mouth, Aaron Copland.
Yeah,
right.
Mm-hmm. And Copland didn't hear it in its symphony version. He heard it in a two-piano version, but he heard it and went, Virgil's onto something here. And they had the same teacher, so marching right along there, but Copland's the name that we know and not Virgil Thompson, but that's the sound.
Well, let's put him on the musical map for our listeners here. Let's listen to Virgil Thompson's A Prayer to St. Catherine, performed by the great Kansas City tenor Nathan Graner.
I went to Siena to St. Catherine's own church. It is impossible to deny this, to pray to her to cure me of my heartache and shyness, which she can do because she's a great saint. Other saints would regard my prayer as foolish. Saint Nicholas, for example, he would chuckle. God helps those who help themselves. Rouse yourself. Get out and do something about it.
That's Nathan Graner. To what extent, Andrew, did Kansas City impact this man's music?
Oh, I think hugely. Mm-hmm. He grew up here and actually had kind of a split personality. He grew up in the Calvary Baptist Church, and so he was singing and playing in the Calvary Baptist Church. But
as a young kid, he was wowing the congregation, right?
Yes. And then as a teenager, he started learning music more professionally, and one of his teachers turned him on to the organist at what's now Grace and Holy Trinity. Right then it was just Grace Cathedral, and invited him down. And so he would go and play the organ at Grace Church every Sunday. And his mom said he could do that only if he went to Sunday school at the Baptist Church first. Had to make sure he had that correct.
He had to pay the price.
He had to pay the price. And those, the sound of those hymns just infiltrate all of his music.
You know, as you just said, at 5, he was playing the piano. At 12, he was a paid organist at the Calvary Baptist Church and absolutely astounded the congregation with his outlandish improvisations. I would have loved to have heard some of that.
It would have been amazing. He stayed with sacred music his entire life. He had this intense interest in it, and it shows up throughout his life. I also think there's an interest in just the way people around here spoke. He talked about his music. He said, "I'm writing Missouri Plain Chant. I'm figuring out how people speak, and that's how I'm going to write my music." And I think you can hear that just with what you heard from Nathan singing, that you can hear every word. You know what he's saying. It makes sense. It sounds like we speak.
Yeah. We're talking about the great Kansas City composer Virgil Thompson. Let's trace his life, because it involved, you know, Kansas City, Harvard, Paris, and so much more. And let's begin with the first sentences of his 1966 autobiography, Andrew. "To anyone," he wrote, "brought up there, as I was, Kansas City always meant the Missouri one. You did not speak of Kansas City, Kansas often, or go there unless you had business." That's a rather blunt statement. What problem did he have with Kansas City, Kansas?
He said that it was too puritanical. He said everyone comes to Kansas City, Missouri for fun. Mm-hmm. They only go over there to Kansas City, Kansas if they have to.
Yeah, so he just wasn't a big fan.
He wasn't a big fan. He always preferred Missouri. He was always focused on Missouri, not on the Kansas side.
So he's here for, what, the first 17, 18 years of his life?
Right.
And then he's off to Harvard.
Well, first he enlists in the military.
Okay.
He takes a, like most young men of his generation, joins up the military. Before he ships out, war's over. So he comes back here, and he actually was good friends with Alice Smith, who's the great-granddaughter of Joseph Smith, founder of the Mormons. And so he gets a scholarship to go to Harvard from the Missouri branch of the Mormon Church.
That's working connections.
That's working connections.
Yeah.
Goes to Harvard, has a great time, joins the Glee Club, which is just being transformed into singing music from the Baroque and the Renaissance. They had previously just been singing with the football games. And they tour Europe, and he falls in love, gets a chance to go back to study, and ends up staying ultimately until 1940, from the 20s of the 1940 in Paris. He said, "If I'm going to starve, I might as well starve where the food's good."
Well, in Paris, he's there during this golden age, of course. Hemingway's there and everybody else. He hangs out with all kinds of people, like who?
Musically, he's hanging out with George Antheil, who's a good friend of his. More important to him, though, were the literary connections that he was making. So he was in the whole kind of Shakespeare and Company crowd that was Ezra Pound, and Gertrude Stein becomes the most important kind of collaborator for him. Mm-hmm. He and Gertrude Stein start working together. He sets a lot of her text to music. He said, "That's kind of the sound of English, and I wanted to set that sound." Mm-hmm. And they ultimately write two operas together.
What a time to be there.
It's just amazing.
And Amy, did you include Paris in your documentary? Did you get to go and film in
well,
Paris?
There's so much to film here.
Yes.
Actually, we probably will do one small shoot in Paris. We've filmed twice in Kansas City, and we have one more major shoot this spring in Kansas City, which we're excited about. But we've also filmed at Tanglewood. We've filmed in San Francisco.
Wow.
And, he made the rounds for sure.
Well, if you need somebody to carry your cameras in Paris.
Sounds like a good plan.
You know who to call.
Yeah.
I'm there. Yeah. His biography says that by his own admission, he was brought to maturity by the composer Edric Satie and the writer Gertrude Stein, as you've already mentioned, Andrew. What influences did those folks have on him?
Well, Satie was a French composer who was really interested in radical simplicity.
Mm-hmm.
He stripped everything away, and this was a time which music was getting more and more complex. And Thompson heard Satie's music and went, "That's what I want to do. I want to have that clarity, that directness." Then there's also a sense of humor in Satie's music. And I always tell my students, this is the hardest thing to accomplish, is to be funny in music. And Satie could do it, and Thompson could do it. And I think he picked that straight up from Satie's music.
And so the impact those two had was profound then.
It was transformational.
Yeah. His greatest achievement in the music world would turn out to be what, Virgil Thompson?
I think it's twofold. I think on the one hand, it's that American voice that I was talking about, the ability to make English sound good, but also it sounds like you would expect America to sound in music. I think the other hand is he was an amazing writer. when he comes back to the United States, he's a critic at the New York Herald Tribune for about 15 years. And during that time, he creates the sense of what a critic should be in the English language in America.
So why isn't he remembered as clearly today as others? I mean, why don't we hear more about him?
Actually, I think it's the backlash of his criticism. He was so good that people weren't quite sure if they wanted to play his music because he might just destroy you in the press. And so you see that as soon as he stops his criticism, invitations for him to perform kind of start tapering off. He falls out of the public eye. And I think that instant, choosing to be a critic and a writer, may have had a backlash on his kind of compositional
career. People just didn't like it.
Yeah.
Yeah. How often did he come back to Kansas City in his later years?
Pretty regularly, actually. Mm-hmm. I know when we did the performance at the Kaufman, Crosby Kemper helped the two of us hosted the entire evening, and he had some great stories about meeting Virgil Thompson when he would come back and do performances here because he enjoyed Kansas City. He liked to be here. He just appreciated the middle America.
I gather you never met him.
I never met him.
Or Amy, you either?
No, unfortunately.
Yeah. Again, we're talking about the great Kansas City composer Virgil Thompson for this segment of our show today. Amy Larrabee, let's turn to the documentary you're making on this man. Again, it's the tentative title, Virgil Thompson, Identifying an American Voice. And let's start with a clip that talks about his influence on scoring for films.
He is looking at it going, well, what does American music sound like? But also, what do these great tractors, there's a great image in The Plow That Broke the Plains of these tractors just coming up over the prairie and going down the plains. And it's the kind of thing that film composers in the 1930s and 40s were coming to grips with as the film language was developing, film musical language was developing as well. And so when you come down to the 1970s, you have composers like John Williams, who's looking back to composers in the 30s and 40s and saying, how did they do that? How did they make those sounds, make that presence, and have music continuously through a film? And Virgil Thompson is doing this. Had a decisive impact on the way film music developed as it went on out of the 1940s.
Andrew, is that your voice?
That was my voice.
You're the narrator, too.
I'm bits and pieces of me throughout the documentary.
You're the multifaceted
I'm
guy
everywhere.
Here. That sounded good. Well, that was from the 1936 John Deere documentary, The Plow That Broke the Plains. Thompson was incorporating folk melodies into his work. How unusual was that for an American composer at that time?
It wasn't that unusual for an American composer, but it hadn't been done that way in film music. Most of the film music composers of the time in the 30s were all European immigrants. They had all fled from Europe and come to Hollywood and made a career composing films. So their music sounded European. And so here comes Virgil Thompson, and they hire him, and he writes the music, and he says, this is set. This is talking about the plains. Let's set the music sounding like the plains. And so he picked up on a couple of hymns, especially How Firm a Foundation is probably the one that you heard most clearly in that clip. And he said, this is what it's going to sound like, and immediately took off.
Well, Amy, how far along in the making of this documentary are you? What stage in the process is this thing?
We have completed most of the filming, with the exception of this last shoot in Kansas City. And we tonight we'll show excerpts from the finished film. So we will be doing the final post-production and editing this summer, and it's in the final stages. When we were talking about How Firm a Foundation, that was when we filmed the symphony in the Flint Hills. Lyle Lovett sang How Firm a Foundation in a small country church, which we filmed. And then in the film, we cut to the Kansas City Symphony performing the symphonic symphony on a hymn tune in the middle of the plains, and it really is beautiful.
I think we have some of that coming up here in just a little bit, because I was at that concert with Lyle Lovett way out in those beautiful Flint Hills out there. So when will this documentary appear on PBS?
It will appear about a year from right now. It will It will be it's part of the American Masters series, which is it is a great honor for someone from Kansas City to be highlighted in the American Masters series. So we will have previews in the fall, and then it's slated to be just early 2014.
You mentioned that you're screening at least parts of the documentary this evening. That's at 6:30 tonight at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the branch on the Country Club Plaza, 4801 Main Street, so you can people can come out and see. Yeah. And you're doing this why? Just to build interest, or what's the point of showing just parts of a film that's not already completed?
Well, so much of Kansas City is already in the film. The performance that we did at the Kaufman Center, it was such a phenomenal evening. We captured a number of Virgil's compositions, all with Kansas City artists. And so we wanted to give those artists the chance to see themselves before we put it in the final cut. So we'll be showing the footage from Helzberg Hall. And by the way, the national audience will just be blown away by Helzberg Hall, how it sounds.
How it comes off.
How it looks. It's just beautiful. So before we do our final shoot in Kansas City this spring, we wanted to show the folks who've already been involved what it looks like. And we'll be filming at Grace and Holy in a couple of months. And all
over. The big cathedral downtown.
Yes. Yeah. The organ there. And it will be so much of Kansas City that was part of Virgil's upbringing is still around. And so the visuals, we wanted to catch them in the spring when it's beautiful.
Hey, how did you get started on making this documentary about Virgil Thompson? What happened to cause you to do all this work on Virgil Thompson?
It really is my co-producers, Jim Arntz and John Paulson, will be together this evening. Jim and I had worked on another project together, and he said, Kansas City, you just have to work with me on this piece on Virgil. KCPT came aboard, and it was...
Off you go.
Yeah.
What was the particular challenge of making this documentary on this man who's not any longer all that well known?
The challenge was doing research, finding people who knew him and could speak about him.
He just died in 89, so I'm sure there's a bunch of folks around still who very well knew Virgil Thompson.
Absolutely, and that's such a treasure. We also have footage of interviews with him, which is really spectacular.
Well, I want to hear another piece of Virgil Thompson's. This is from the Kansas City Symphony's Homecoming and Evening with Virgil T., which took place in October of 2011. This is the UMKC Brass Quintet playing the prelude of the suite we discussed earlier, The Plow That Broke the Prairie. You know, I'm not a music expert, but you can hear the Midwest.
You can.
In that music, can't you?
Yeah.
It's so true. Did he struggle in the making, in the writing of the music that he made?
As far as I know, he was pretty proficient. All the pictures I've seen, actually, he's laying in bed and composing. That was his favorite place to compose. So I think it was a pretty natural feed for him.
I hate people like that.
he just rolled with it.
Didn't
suffer and sweat and...
Oh, no. He had a good time his entire life. He loved to eat. He loved conversation. He lived a good life.
And again, he was just enormously gifted. I guess that goes without saying here. This was a man who just had it.
He just had intellect. He had musical ability, writing ability. He could do it all.
Hmm. Just as fitting to play music in Kansas City is playing it in the landscape that inspired the composer. We talked a few minutes ago about him, the Kansas City Symphony, playing in the Flint Hills. Let's listen to a little bit from that performance. And this song, again, is what, Amy?
Symphony on a Hymn Tune.
Okay.
I think we're in a period of rediscovery as Americans right now in music of the early 20th century. I think the symphony has really taken advantage of an opportunity to become an artistic leader. To be able to perform his music in the space that surrounded them makes you feel closer to them. And when you feel closer to the composer, something really magic happens with the score and with the musicians.
Andrew Grenade, this whole notion of the Kansas City Symphony performing these performances in the Flint Hills once a year, you just got to wonder how he would have responded to being to sitting in the audience for one of those performances.
I think he would have been flattered.
I think he would have gone nuts.
I think absolutely.
Yeah.
To have his hometown symphony playing his music in that kind of setting, just gorgeous.
Is his home still here? Is it marked or memorialized in any way?
It's not marked.
Where is it?
Is it on Wabash?
Wabash.
Yeah. So you can drive by and still see. I've been tempted to go up and knock on the door some time ago. Do you know that? But I haven't done it yet.
You wonder, don't you?
Yeah. I actually, when Jim and John and I first kicked the whole idea around, I drove to the location and took a picture of the house, and I said, I'm really here. And then I thought, God, these people probably wonder what I'm doing. But it is, we will be knocking on the door, and we will be showing this very humble, very beautiful little Midwestern home and all of the places where he hung out as a kid.
Again, Andrew, you know, listening to his music, I can't help but wonder who came first, Aaron Copland or the man we're talking about today, Virgil Thompson?
It's a tangled little web.
I was going to say.
Yeah, they were both in Paris at the same time. They studied with the same teacher, Nadia Boulanger. They both were interested in doing this kind of setting, but Symphony on a Hymn Tune chronologically is the first big symphonic work that uses these hymn tunes and uses this American sound. Comes before Aaron Copland was doing it.
And you think that the reason Copland's name still resonates with Americans today as opposed to Virgil Thompson's is this idea that Thompson was writing music criticism and just made a lot of people angry with his comments.
I think that's the best.
And Aaron Copland didn't do that.
Yeah, and Aaron Copland, they were both supporting younger composers. I mean, a lot of the kind of ideas that they were espousing that other people were picking up on. I think it was partially the time that he was in Paris until 1940, so he was out of the country for 15 years, and he comes back and he's a critic, and people are not quite sure how to approach him.
Well, as you look at these two men, Aaron Copland and Virgil Thompson, which one ranks as the better composer?
Oh, such a subjective question.
Well, of course it is.
For my taste, I enjoy Virgil Thompson's music better.
Because?
There's that radical simplicity and that kind of tongue-in-cheekness to his music that you don't get. Aaron Copland is super serious and beautiful music and well-constructed, but for me, Thompson has that little edge that I really like in music.
Amy, can you tell much of a difference?
Thompson's film music really, as a documentary filmmaker, I see the magic when you've put everything together and then the music is added and it is this layer that is so important.
Mm-hmm.
I can close my eyes with Thompson's music and just see what he is describing. So the more I've gotten to know his music, the more I feel that it's just, it evokes such powerful images.
Yeah. Andrew, other musicologists around the country, critics, analysts, they would rank Copland or Thompson as the better, composer.
Copland has the bigger press and the bigger presence.
Boy, no kidding.
Yeah. He's been more talked about. His music's been more analyzed. It's been more performed. And so I think in that kind of judgment of history, Copland comes out ahead.
Is Virgil Thompson's family, is there any resentment about that?
Not that I know. I have to throw to Amy that question.
Because you can't help but wonder.
We haven't uncovered that. And in fact, in the interviews that we've done on camera with various folks from Yale and Harvard, it is, you know, within a certain community, it is this special, the breadth of Thompson's work that I think people in music so appreciate.
Does he have family who live around town today?
He does. And that's our final round of interviews, too. We will be interviewing his family. They came to the event at the Kauffman Center, and we're really anxious to dig into some more of that personal history.
And these are his children?
Cousins and offspring of cousins.
Did he have children?
No.
That makes it a little harder then.
It does.
Maybe that's one more reason why he's not as well known, the family not pushing his name going forward.
Yeah. Okay. As we've interviewed folks in New York, he lived at the Chelsea Hotel at the end of his life. Mm-hmm. And there was this great group of characters who lived there. They speak about coming back here for Virgil's burial outside of Kansas City.
Yeah.
And it was a very small group who even attended his burial. But they said as on the plains in this tiny little country cemetery, as they were all walking away on this cloudy, kind of cold day, this stranger just appeared out of nowhere walking over the hill with this cart.
Hmm.
And they said, there went Virgil.
Hmm.
He would be very happy that he wound up here. And so we do have some great memories of him firsthand.
Well, that's a good way to end our segment on Virgil Thompson. I want to thank Andrew Grenade from UMKC. Thanks so much for your time
today. Absolutely, it's fun.
And Amy Larrabee, thank you for coming in today.
Thank you.
And again, if folks want to see advanced footage of the Virgil Thompson documentary, 6:30 tonight at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library on the Plaza, 4801 Main Street. Coming up, reactions to President Barack Obama's State of the Union address last night. Call us with your reactions. How good a speech was it? What did he leave out? What did he include that you applauded? 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, up to date at kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Missouri Congressman Emanuel Cleaver will be joining us in just a couple minutes. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star. And you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR.